Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice TV. We have another interview lined up for you guys today. We are going to talk about the power brokers that you never elected. We have a new documentary out. One of my good associates, friends, I'm not sure what to call him, Jonas Nilsson over in Sweden. He's a fellow countryman, I guess that's the best way of saying it, from Palestra Media. He's produced this documentary. I watched it again last night, yesterday, go through it. And he's very on top of all the latest kind of developments when it comes to a lot of the NGOs, these kind of so-called philanthropists, right? We're talking about things from the World Economic Forum to Bill Gates to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, all these globalist organizations that have been dictating things, well, actually in the last few decades, but they've really stepped up to the forefront over the last couple of years using the COVID pandemic, piggybacking on this disease, and using that to kind of advance their agenda and their goal. But anyway, it's going to be a good show. I think we have a lot to get into. Jonas, welcome back. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, likewise. I'm very glad to be back on the show and glad to see you again. Good health.
Absolutely. Thank you. Hope you've been doing well since we spoke last time. So tell us lots to get into here, obviously, and tell us a bit why you wanted to make this the documentary and why you started looking at things in this direction. I know you've been interested in this in a long time, and of course, you know, last time you were on, we were speaking about the what's happening in Sweden, the migration issue, kind of the destruction of the West, and these kinds of things. But of course, this fits another topic that fits perfectly right into what the objectives is here, to basically create a cosmopolitan, rootless, globalist human that basically these people can manage very well. But tell us about when you decided to make it.
We're a small production company. It's just me and some fellow co-workers that put in volunteer hours, non-paid. And we had a passion project that we wanted to, mostly driven by me. And that was about the Christian faith and how that relates to the opposition, because in Sweden at least, or and I believe in many Western countries, maybe some parts of America is an exception, but the institution of the church is not longer a religious institution, it's a political institution for this globalist, the same thing. And I have a very strong family background within the Swedish church. Amongst other things, my grandmother's brother is the one that put together our psalm book and was the king's priest. And we had, I have many reverends within the family. So, and all those goes back where their religious belief aligns somewhere into a political outcome that have bring us forward to this position. But anyway, we decided to halt that project because we were in the midst of this pandemic. And as you said in the introduction, these globalists, these NGOs, and these different branches of the big finance have really put up a gear within this pandemic years. And they have accelerated to that degree. So we felt that even though this project where we want to portray the faith in a different light, that can wait because now we are in the midst of something more urgent. So we started to put some focus in what is it that happens here within this pandemic, because lots of these policies decision that took place didn't seem to come from bottom down, because on the paper at least we are a representative parliament. Our democracy is based on representative in our parliament, and they are going to represent the people or the districts that have voted for them. And then you should think that the policies decision that they put forward should have some foundation within the group of voters that have voted for them. And within this pandemic, it became very clear that our politicians were more aligned with the other politicians in other countries. That is, our elite were more in line with other countries' elite than they were with their own population. And everything they have done so far during this pandemic has been breathing in the same pace as other countries. And that is very weird if we are going to consider ourselves to be a sovereign nations who are also democracies. Then you should see a big disparity within the political outcome when you look at different questions. And you see that in all regards, except for some key aspects. And those key aspects is when it comes to the climate crisis, the global agenda of 2030, and the migration policies, and also now the COVID policies to stop this pandemic. So it's quite obvious when you look at these things that this is not from the bottom down, the resolution of how we're going to deal with these so-called problems. I call it so-called problems. Of course, there is some legitimacy to it, but it's very clear that this is centralized planned policy decisions that is grouping out to our political leadership. And that raises the question, what and how can our elected politician be influenced to take a decision that goes against the population that they themselves, at least on paper, should represent?
Yes, exactly. And in the documentary, you bring up a couple of cases where this has been exposed, right? It happened in Canada, where it became known, and much to the thanks to Klaus Schwab himself, speaking about how they have penetrated, that was the word he used, the cabinet, especially in Canada, but many other countries as well. He mentioned Australia, he mentioned Argentina, but most of the Western governments are infested, that's the term I'd like to use, by the World Economic Forum, the Agenda 2030, that's like the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, those kinds of agendas. We had one scenario as well that you bring up from Holland, which was actually pretty interesting, where I think it was the Freedom Party for Democracy and Freedom, I think they're called, right, in Holland, Netherlands, that actually got some of the documents out, printed out the letters that have been gone back and forth between the Dutch PM Rutte and Klaus Schwab, and I think there was a couple of other ministers as well. And it was like, Klaus was like open about that, like, because you're cooperating, you know, with us, you've been so good for the Great Reset and the bigger agenda. You and your country is going to have a great part in the exact wording was something like, when we rebuild or restructure the global shipping, basically, or like the new supply chain that we're setting up, that technically, I think, should be like a criminal investigation, I would assume, when you all of a sudden have an unelected person having a direct relationship with an elected politician, and they're scheming about what to do in the future. I haven't heard much about this, but it was exposed. I mean, you have it in your documentary, Jonas.
Yeah, I think you're right. To use the word influence is very humble. It's
yeah.
definitely something more stronger than that. And but no, it's not an act of criminality, because it's only an act of criminality if you, as a local entrepreneur, like small business in the small community, if you buy dinner for your local representative and try to influence him in some policymakers, then the judicial system will look very harshly on it. But now when it is on this global level and with the big business and with our political elite, then it's a carte blanche. And these letters, that was made public by the Netherlands, these are not unique for the Netherlands.
No.
This correspondence is with every Western leaders, which is under this influence from the World Economic Forum. And I would like to do a shout out. I will see if I get the name right there. I think it's Björn Tischer, a former member of the Moderate Party in Sweden, that did a good job to, thanks to the offentlighetsprincipen, the principle of in Sweden, all they say that the spies in Sweden never needs to break the law because everything is public. But the thing is, you need to demand it out. And this former member of the moderate party, contacted the Swedish authorities on different levels and asked to get out all the emails where World Economic Forum was one of the respondents. And it was actually, I don't know how many thousands of documents it was, but some of those documents are also in the documentary, in the ending scenes where we go in a little bit with not really pay to play, but that is also definitely a part of it. But like role reversed, like if you have been in the service, a good service from the politician doesn't make any money. Like have that clear.
Yeah, like significant money, right? Yeah.
No, it's pocket money.
Yes.
In the big schemes of things, they make maybe $10,000 a month, and still. Some of the most corrupt politicians that is in the good footing with these globalists are multi-millionaires, even though they have never worked outside the realms of politics one single day of their entire life. Like take Joe Biden and his son, for an example, or take Zelensky, the Ukrainian prime minister or president, who were a former actor. So yeah. Multi-dollar millionaire.
Yep.
And this comes for this politician for selling out their country for this to this big financial elite. And to make a long story short, so these documents between the World Economic Forum and the Swedish authorities, during this pandemic, we had the Prime Minister of Stefan Löfven, and he resigned just 6 months ago. And in the parliament, one of our members of parliament for the Swedish Democrats asked him, so now when you have been very generous with the Swedish tax money, where do you think we will find you with your next job? Will it maybe be at a top job within this some globalist organization? And our prime minister responded like, that's a very insulting question that I will not respond to, because that's beneath me and it should be beneath you to even ask such a question. And just like literally, like 3 weeks after he resigns as prime minister, he gets this top job within the United Nations. And he's definitely not a very qualified person. The only thing that he has going for him is that he has been loyal to this globalist agenda.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's so corrupt, right? He was like, as you said, it's beneath me to even address that question. Well, like, there was obviously an honest question. And I think he mentions it as well, how Stefan Löfven at the time, our former prime minister in Sweden, funneled like what millions of Swedish crowns out of, you know, from the taxpayer as I'm not sure if it was aid or specific. I mean, there's probably like there's so many programs out there and stuff, but I see Trudeau all the time as well. They just like millions and millions in these aid programs and giving it to the third world. They give it to, you know, the World Economic Forum or some other globalist organization. It's incredible just how much money these politicians are squandering. Then we're like left with nothing. I mean, Sweden, if you just talk about that for a second, Sweden is a rich country comparable, you know, to many other countries around the world, but the population is not wealthy, right? It's like Norway. They have like the biggest sovereign wealth fund in the world or something like that. Mm-hmm. Norwegians are better off than Swedes, I'm not trying to say that, but still comparatively, the people can be you know, poor, and look at how our countries are collapsing right now. I mean, utterly falling apart with everything that's happening, and yet these politicians just continue to be in this position, and they funnel out the millions. You know, so it's criminal. Yeah. It's criminal.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because people have this idea of big business now that they are free market entrepreneurs, and it's the biggest lies that is out there, because there is no money like tax money. It's to get within the corrupt political elite is to enforce consumers to you. It's freebies. And it's not small money. They can make much, much more money by a proxy with the governments that they could ever do on the free market. And they also use the same government that they help rob us citizens. They also use those governments to put in regulations that will prevent any form of competition that will could arise on the free market. So they have a really good, strong neck hold on the entire system for them to maintain their power position.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, in the beginning as well, you talk about the, you know, the just the power of these financial institutions, these neoliberal capitalist institutions. But again, it's not only now about making money, right? We're talking about things such as BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street. There's a couple of other ones down the list of like these are major, you know, they're investment management firms, but they also are holding companies, right? So basically, you reference Monopoly, and I remember watching that a while ago. We promoted it as well. Great documentary. I think the guy is living in Holland, again, Netherlands, who did it. And just exposing like that all the supposed even competitors on the global capitalist scene are all owned by the same businesses. I mean, I think we have the story here. BlackRock is now managing $10 trillion in assets. It's never, I mean, there was like this benchmark or milestone, whatever you want to call it, where they, we've never seen this amount of influence, this amount of money, this amount of control. And again, I think it was the COVID pandemic that kind of pushed them over the edge here as well. We saw just a massive consolidation of wealth after the COVID pandemic. Some of the wealthiest people got like three times as wealthy, you know, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, of course. We'll talk more about him later. But, what has happened here is they're now using the vehicle of neoliberal capitalism as a way to kind of, you know, inflict upon the rest of us, you know, the same social justice and the same, I mean, just let's call it a commie gobbledygook. I mean, the mind of these CEOs and people, they're pushing, you know, the Black Lives Matter thing. They look the other way for Antifa and stuff, right? And central to that role, I think, has been people like Klaus Schwab to kind of connect the business world with the wider agenda of, you know, not only globalization, but like this social justice, right? One of the things that we've seen recently is the ESGs, right? That's what they talk about now. It's basically like a social credit score for businesses, for corporations. ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance, right? Klaus Schwab calls it stakeholder capitalism. You know, these things weave into each other and they produce the same thing at the end of it, where you basically have these companies, I would assume for the most part, volunteer to go into this program. Same thing with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal, that they'll sign up for this and then say, well, what have you done, you know, to advance this agenda for equity and for, you know, countering global warming and these kinds of things. It's, what do you feel about, like, why are they going along with this? Isn't it kind of strange? You think some of these powerful businesses would be like, okay, well, that's great, but that's not what we're going to do. We're gonna keep doing our thing and just make as much money as possible. How do you explain that?
It's a hard question to grapple with, but their ambition is obviously higher, and I think you need to look at it as the pursuit of power in some fundamental way, and what's really disgusting with it. That's the way how they frame it. They frame it that we need to have social equity over the world. The rich is getting richer and the poor is getting poorer, and we need to lift up this poor, and we can't be egoists that are rich. We need to share our wealth with the poor countries. And when they say stuff like this, they don't refer to themselves, as you said, that some of the very richest people of this world has tripled their net worth during this pandemic. No, they mean us, the regular citizens of the Western world, who are already really struggling just to get away with the life that we had, the financial life that we had before the pandemic. It's hard for families to just fill up this car these days.
I know.
But it is us that is the reference point to create this world of equality. And in the end, if it goes that route, what it is that we will have a very powerful elite that will have a more easily controlled mass of people, regardless of where they are, because we are too poor and we are too dependent on their paycheck, if it even is a paycheck, maybe it's just a grant or a bidrag.
Yeah,
I need to point out that it's in the documentary. It's not my English that you will hear. It's it's dubbed.
Yes.
But unfortunately, this session can't be.
You're doing fine. Don't worry about it. No, it's great. It's a great film, and it ties all these things together in a very, you know, it's just like makes perfect sense. You know what I mean? Like from one thing to another, just how it all connects. These big globalist, you know, kind of institutions, right? So we do have a number of them, of course, a number of people as well. But again, Klaus Schwab, you know, people have, you know, quite. How come he got so much power? In a way, I think he's just a front man, to be honest, of sorts. He's kind of, you know, it's silly, but he kind of fulfills that role as well of like some kind of, I know, you know, his German accent, it's like this Bond villain type thing, which is kind of like, yeah. I'm not sure that's the best optics, but if you want to, let's say if you subconsciously want to, give out the impression that these people are very powerful, and not maybe that you should be afraid of them, but like basically these are bigger you know entities, these are bigger people than you can ever deal with. I guess that would make sense of why they would do it from that perspective. But what do you think of Klaus Schwab just kind of being a front man of sorts? Because these are, you know, the Davos group, we're talking about the world. There's other, I think there's a lot of other institutions like behind this. But what do you think?
He's a front man, that you need to look at his organization, World Economic Forum, and who finance it. Who is it that gives them the leverage to be that platform that they are? There is a reason for that, and that is not because of Klaus Schwab's brilliance. It's because that the big financial elite needs a platform that can cut through the social, cultural, and political life of the world, and that needs to be in some sort of plain sight to actually have some effect. Of course, there are some hidden groups like the Bilderberg Group, but sometimes if you want to influence on a more broader scale, because they are very open. It's a very interesting thing when you're working with what people would consider to be conspiracy theories. It's the only reason why what we are talking here about the Great Reset, World Economic Forum, and their influence towards the Western world primarily is considered a conspiracy theory is because it's not highlighted within the media establishment, which is owned by the same financial elite that financed World Economic Forum. But everything is in plain sight. So you can either choose to see it or you can choose not to see it. And I think many people choose not to see it because they will have to revise so much of how they perceive their world that it's easier to dismiss it as a conspiracy theory because they haven't read about it or heard about it on CNN.
Yeah. Yeah, and they still, you know, you look at how they treat the Great Reset or something like that in mainstream media. There's that. Yeah. No, it's a crazy conspiracy theory. And then you go and read, like, what they actually write about it. And it's like, well, this is what we've talked, global governance. It's an overarching body that's trying to organize countries, you know, to bring them together. It's the same thing with, like, the New World Order conspiracy kind of thing, right? Yeah. I just saw a perfect screenshot the other day of someone, like, comparing what the Wikipedia said about the New World Order conspiracy versus the... Yeah. The political movement of the New World Order, and it was like it's
same
the same
picture.
Thing. It's like, what are you talking about? It's not a big difference. But the Bilderberg Group was like that was hush hush as well for many, you know, decades. A lot of Swedes, by the way, have gone there. The Wallenberg family, yeah. Carl Bildt. You know, there's a number of these people, you know, business people as well. And
that's quite interesting.
It is.
Because Jesper Johansson, a brilliant journalist in Sweden, actually caught Carl Bildt, and it's within this documentary as well, and asked him about these secret meetings. And the first things that pops into Carl Bildt's head is that, no, but this is nothing weird. We have secret meetings all the time in the government.
Yeah, exactly. Therefore, we can go and cut deals with business people behind your backs. This is crazy. I'm playing the clip right here. Not the audio of it, but he's finally being confronted. This guy, I got to say, this guy has been a very important node point in the network of globalists, right? He's been involved in Yugoslavia, right? The war, Bosnia, that whole, the Balkans, basically. He was a big player there, right? There it is in the documentary, the Wallenberg family as well, hugely influential as well in Sweden, right?
Yeah.
So what do you make of, so we're talking about the Bilderberg Group, and they kind of went from being covert and secret to public eventually. When there was enough highlighting from like crazy conspiracy theorists out there, they basically took it public. They didn't have a website before. Now it's BilderbergMeetings.org. Now it's like open. And it was the same thing with the World Economic Forum in a way. They were never as secret as the Bilderberg Group, but they were kind of in the background, and at least in my by my perception, it was really during the pandemic that they stepped up into a much more open and prominent role and being kind of promoted as well, right? We have and you included some of these as well, about like these famous meme, you know, they've become memes now, but these like videos that they released, right? Eight predictions of the world. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy, right? Like, well, just straight in the open. Like, the disillusion of private property, you'll own nothing, you'll be eating bugs, less meat, you will live in big cities, and basically it will all be internationalism. That was kind of, not a shock to a lot of people, but it was like, wow, they're just going openly for this, you know, they're just right in the open.
Yeah, I think it's two-folded. One is that what you're into, that the oppositional media or alternative media has been very effective of highlighting what they are doing. So they feel that it's better to show a facade that they can themselves portray a little bit and control. But the other side, I think a big difference from maybe the 70s or 60s or 50s is that they have now such a huge influence of our government and world in all its aspects, so they feel they can be more open because the opposition doesn't reach in within those establishment like they could have maybe back a couple of decades ago.
Yeah, no, it's true. It is true. And to some extent, for it to be able to begin manifesting itself, they have to be out in the open with it. They have to, because, you know, these are active policies that they want to implement and stuff like that. And of course, you highlight some of them as well in the documentary. And again, COVID has been central in this thing, right? We're talking about things such as tracking and tracing everybody. And of course, we got that with the so-called social distancing, the tracing and tracking apps that bled into the vaccination program, the global vaccination program. Well, but primarily in the West, that's where the mRNA technology so far have been rolled out. But the vaccine passport to confirm your vaccination status, that became started being hinged on things such a digital ID. You need to store information digitally, right? And even Klaus Schwab, maybe that's one of the clips we should play, but when he talks about the fourth industrial revolution, for example, he mentioned these kinds of things. He even talks about, you know, gene editing, you know, things like that. If you want to be, more specific, let's play that one clip where he's talking about that. Let me see here. The fourth industrial revolution, that's one of them. Let's check out this one right here first.
What the fourth industrial revolution will lead to is a fusion of our physical, our digital, and our biological identities. When I wrote the book, I started to write it four years ago. It was published 3 years ago. It was sold, very interesting, over a million times in the world. And what is interesting is that 800,000 copies, more than 800,000 copies of those 2 million were sold in three countries alone: China, Japan, and South Korea. And you may be interested, who was the biggest buyer with 16,000 copies at the same time? It was the Korean military. Because the fourth industrial revolution will have a major impact also on warfare.
On warfare, yeah, there you go. Yeah, so COVID-19, the Great Reset, and then shaping the future of the fourth industrial revolution, and then he did, a second version of that, just called the fourth industrial revolution, right? This kind of bleeds into things like transhumanism, really, a post-human world, right? They're replacing us with automation, our jobs. They basically need us in a position where we have total obedience to the system, right? The social credit score that ties into the digital ID that they've been talking about. And again, Jonas, COVID really like spearheaded this and again pushed it right in the forefront officially. And you saw a large segment of the population therefore agree to it. And you cover that. Maybe that's a good point we should go into, but just how the fear-mongering around something like the pandemic is always a necessity to get people to change. And I've heard these globalists over and over and over again talking about this. Don't let a good crisis go to waste. You always need to use it. You need to utilize it. But you also need a driver of an incentive, basically, a stick together with a carrot of why people need to change their behavior and go in a new direction, right? And the pandemic was like perfect for this.
Yeah. And that meme that or their commercial that has become a meme, you will own nothing and you will be happy. The ideas from this that will develop into this great research with this social credit score and digital ID and complete control over the citizenry. The only reason why they did not launch the Great Reason, in my opinion, of course it's speculative, but that's because we weren't scared enough for the climate crisis.
Exactly.
That they didn't feel that they could roll it out. They tried, but it was too much of resistance, or not maybe not resistance in that sense. It was with this COVID, they didn't face resistance. They faced people sharing them on, people that were like really out there and try to enforce their policy decision with these mask mandates and these lockdowns. You had good neighbors, previously good neighbors, that were willing to call the police if they saw their neighbor walking outside during the lockdown.
Yep.
To rat them out. And this globalist elite could not manage to get the people into that state due to climate hysteria.
And they tried. So that's, oh boy, did they try.
Yeah, they tried. Yes.
I mean, the crazy, and again, actually, Sweden was on the forefront of this in regards to not only Greta Thunberg as a spokesperson, and she's meeting with all the, you know, John Kerry and all.
And that's the thing. So, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah,
you,
no, go ahead.
They use Greta Thunberg as this leverage and wanted her to get through with the climate hysteria. But now they reuse all these actors that had their place in a specific field, and they tried to use their like made up authority in different fields. So you have Greta Thunberg making comments on the pandemic on the behalf of World Economic Forum.
Yeah.
At the same time, you have people like Dr. Fauci, who is like specialty is this field of medicine, but he is in commercial for World Economic Forum about poverty.
Exactly. I know. Yeah, equity was a huge part of when we solved the pandemic, you know, and again, it's not over. That's going to come back or whatever. But yeah, then we need to use that as an opportunity to solve equity and, social justice. And we need to have more diversity and, corporate boards and stuff. And again, it doesn't matter what crisis they throw at us. It's always the same, solution, whether it's climate change. Well, then we have to do all these things. Right. And that ties into, the United Nations Agenda 2030, kind of AKA, it's like interchangeable with what they call the Sustainable Development Goals. And in fact, look at like this screenshot here. Here's one of them. Excuse me. Here it is right here, right? Migration data and the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, right? And so many of these are politicians and leaders are talking about that right now. And they say here too, migration is, we're going into migration here a little bit now, but migration is a cross-cutting issue in the 2030 agenda relevant to the Sustainable Development Goals. At least 10 out of 17 goals, in other words, a majority of the Sustainable Development Goals contain targets and indicators that are directly relevant to migration. Isn't that interesting, right? Because we're talking about this rootless, cosmopolitan, new post-human, basically, essentially, that they need to create. Look, if we were engaged in our national interest and our traditions and our culture and our language and all these things, it would be much harder to implement a global governance system, which they're trying right now. And so nationalism, UNAS, has been one of the big obstacles for them that they've had to overcome. And I think that they're seeking to solve that partially by bringing massive amounts of migrants into the Western world. And then I think in their view, ideally, have us intermingle to mix, essentially, to further kind of water down our cultural heritage. What do you, and our ethnic heritage, too, of course. But what do you make of that?
I find that not just plausible. I find that without any reasonable doubt that that is the case. By opening up borders, you're removing all sentiment that there exists an us, which the politics can take its form, that we use politics to cater for the interests of a group of people. And when you remove that, then there is no real interest to leverage against the globalist agenda. So if you see how the globalist elite with their media and the politician, how they portray people that that speaks about putting their nation first, like Poland, Hungary, Donald Trump, for instance, in America, they are being attacked with all these people have. And the reason is because when they come with this global policy that is centrally created from one of these forums and then going to be implemented in the Western world, then you have leaders who doesn't care that they represent a specific people, that will just represent their own selfish interest, that sell out their people and their country. And you have people that leaders that actually care about their people, and they will look at these policy decisions or the policy that is centrally created and actually ask the question, how will this affect people that has elected me to represent them? And then it will be a hazard if every so-called sovereign nation actually took that into question when we put these things in place. How does this affect my people? And I think more often than not, the answer will be that this will not be in my people's interest to do as this globalist elite want us to do.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And I mean, one of the people there, even I was showing a picture of him there from the World Economic Forum, because we, you know, the World Economic Forum is not doing those kinds of things. Well, no, they are. they're all doing it, right? Here's one guy, Shandan Nair, right? He's associated with the World Economic Forum, and on the website for them, it says this: the kind of the focus of him. Well, I can say first, he's the founder and CEO of the Global Institute for Tomorrow, GIFT, perfect, right? The shift of economic and political influence from the West to Asia, reshaping of the rulers, so the rules of global capitalism, reshaping capitalism and saving the planet. It's always that. We've got to save the planet somehow. His new book, Dismantling Global White Privilege, Equity for a Post-Western World. And, of course, he's also executive committee of the Club of Rome, which is another one of these massive globalist organizations that have been very heavy in pushing, you know, climate change. And, you know, they had a book called The Limits to Growth. Is one of their big kind of reports that they released way back. But here's his book right there, Dismantling Global White Privilege, Equity for a Post-Western World. So all these institutions are, they're all moving in the same direction. It's all about this, the white supremacy is a global threat, and we have to all, basically we have to dismantle and bring the Western civilization down to its knees. That's what I feel. I feel, to extend it further, it's to have kind of a controlled demolition of our societies right now. Because again, if you're going to have a great reset, well, then you have to have a great collapse first, in a way, right? This is like the phoenix. You have to have something rise out of the ashes at the end, And they need to burn things down, essentially, again, as an incentive for us for, well, why should we go in? If things are going great. If things are going great and fantastic, why will we change, right, Jonas?
Yeah. No, and they do it so simplified as well. For example, I'm in Sweden. I live in Sigtuna, which is the oldest maintained town in Sweden. So it's the old capital. That was the capital before Stockholm. So this is somewhat the birthplace of Sweden. Sweden is one of the oldest nations in the world. We are over 1,000 year old, and it was created here in the middle of Sweden. And they try to put the same narrative, and very successfully so, because you can hear it amongst the random Swedes, not just from the institution, but it's propagandized, and the people are being indoctrinated to it, that we are in the same situation, for example, as the Americans, that you have a native population. So when Sweden was created, it was only Swedes here. There's no question about it. And our nation's name is our people's name. Yep. Which is even a further indicator. And up north, the genetic people of the Swedes arrived here long before Sweden were a country. But up north in Sweden, we have a small minority population, which is called the Samis. And they would be our equivalent of the Native Americans, if you're going to believe this propaganda of theirs. But there were no Samis around Sigtuna or where Sweden had its birth. We encountered them much, much later, maybe 500 years later for the first time. But even then, when you look at the archaeological remains, it's our people who were even first up north. And the Sami arrived over the Russian steppe much later.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. Everything they say has nothing to do with searching for truth. It's only pretext to get their agenda through, and they will do whatever it takes for them to do that. And if someone states the facts like I did here, which it's nothing to discuss really, because it's ipso facto, it's truth within itself. You will be dismantled as a racist or someone who want to oppress the Samis by not acknowledge that they were the native population of Sweden, which is utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, they're doing this kind of American, so much is driven by American media and even culture, academia to a certain extent, right, and methods of control and subversion and stuff. I mean, look, the Brits are pretty good at it too. The Tavistock Institute, there's certain groups that have been doing this for a long time, subversive things. But it's just the media specifically so dominant in America that's like, you know, someone made the example the other way, like the other day. People have, you know and have heard of, and some of them have even been in the streets to fight for George Floyd, but they never heard of Ebba Åkerlund, for example. Or, you know, there's like countless examples like that where it's so dominant by that, right? But that whole, you know, oh, Nate, you killed the natives kind of thing. The fact that they've been trying to, like, weave that into European culture and society is not only indicative of how successful that is, but how utterly just, absurd it is, frankly. That's the word, the best word. It's so absurd to try to basically hoodwink an entire people, and you know, much of Europe is like that now, too, an entire people, entire group, into thinking that they're native to nowhere, and they're wherever they go, they're always an invader and a colonizer, these kinds of things. And I want to play one clip, you know, real quick, and if you want to comment on it, go ahead, but listen to this. Here's Klaus Schwab again. We talked about this thing with, you know, nationalism, a global, cosmopolitan, globalist, rootless, deracinated individual. Here's Klaus Schwab harping on nationalism here.
Fragmented global architecture is not fit anymore for purpose in the 21st century. It's high time for a great reset. Change is not happening. We have a choice to stay passive and see the negative trends unravel. Inequality, polarization, nationalism, racism. If we do not stop those trends, we'll lead to a post-corona world that definitively is less sustainable, less equal, and much more fragile.
So it's always this threat of, like, if you don't obey, you're going to die. That's kind of always what it comes down to, right? In a way.
Yeah, it's like the rhetoric from Joe Biden that we are waiting. The vaccinated people will have a lovely Christmas, and those who haven't vaccinated will die.
A dark winter. I know, they've been saying that over and over again. Ironically, the reverse is too, so much of it is, right? But no, yeah. Nationalism, huge problem. That's the big, if not the biggest enemy, it's one of the big ones, right? And they have to do away with that in order to bring in their new global equity, world of equity and sustainability and environmentalism. And there's still, I think, some people, we can get into this in the second part too, but they genuinely believe that, well, you know, this is will be better and we have to, you know, do these things and this is the only option that we have. And again, they're scared to death by, they think that the climate change is going to kill humans here within, what is it now, they said 12 years a few years ago, so maybe, I don't know what we have left, 6-8 years, something like that. And if it's not that, it's the pandemic. And if it's not the pandemic, it's a world war, right? Which is, I want to also talk with you about Ukraine, even that, the Ukraine-Russia thing fits, I should say, perfectly into the wider context of what's happening here. And we, you know, the much of what the World Economic Forum is pushing on us is things like supply chain, right? They want to have blockchain based, you know, shipping, basically. They want to have ID systems. It's kind of a ubiquitous surveillance system, essentially, right? The whole fourth industrial revolution, if they want to have robotics and artificial intelligence running things, right? You need to have global coverage of like things like 5G, so everything's connected all the time. Everything needs to have its own internet address or IP address, and everything needs to be in constant communication with each other itself in order to organize this whole automized artificial intelligence world that they're building for us.
Yeah, and it's complete. It's very, very scary. Firstly, that they use all these smooth words of describing this world that they want to create, which makes it very easy for the broader populace that doesn't really do more than just scratch the surface to buy into it, because these value words has a nice tone to it to most people. But what people need to have in mind is that this is not just a development of service for every ordinary man, because in some sense it is, because it makes life easier in many regards. We have in Sweden, since a couple of years ago, we introduced a bank identification that makes us sign contracts from a distance to identify that we are, so we can do a digital signature. And this, of course, makes life very smooth in many regards. The problem compared to what we have and what we will get is the complete automation of it, that there's no way to round the system. So when everyone is plugged into it, and I think we really need to look at this vaccine passport as a test run of the entire thing on a small scale, even though this vaccine passport were massively adopted worldwide. And that is what will happen when they just decide to unlink a person from this automated system, which they can easily do because it's centralized controlled.
Exactly. At any point, they can basically just say, "Nope, you haven't obeyed enough. We're going to cut you off." If there's any kind of UBI system, right, a universal basic income, or, you know, call it whatever you want. Basically, a look, when the jobs are not there, when there's most of it anyway is being automated, what are we going to do, right? What's going to happen? Even in fact, he has a. Maybe we should play some clips of those in the second part here. But the World Economic Forum has a kind of an top advisor, I think he's called, to Klaus Schwab. He's a gay Israeli guy called Hariri, I think it is. Yuval Noah Harari, I think it is, right? And he's been talking about this, too, of like, you know, kind of a social-based credit score system, but it's also talked about how, like, irrelevance is one of the big problems, allegedly, in this future world of theirs that they're building, that basically you have to be, you know, you might be still, of course, important, he says, to your family and your friends and these kinds of things, but in the overarching scheme of things, it's going to be all about, like, I guess, an influencer, I guess that's the biggest job people are going to have in the future. How much attention, the attention economy, how much attention do you get, right? Are you valuable, speaking to, you know, from the point of view of the system in and of itself? But again, if you do anything, if you're a dissident, if you're a thought criminal, if you come up against a little playpen that they've put for us of where we can operate within, well, they can shut you down, and they're doing those things in China right now, right? You included it in the documentary of the guy who can't buy train tickets, for example, right? Because he's been critical of the government.
We are old enough to actually have friends that lived within the Soviet Union, and my wife comes from Estonia, and my family, on her side of the family, we still have family living there. And back in the days, if they had a job, which were very irrelevant of the schemes of things, it could be working on a hotel that didn't have any guests at all, except maybe some Russians that were coming over that worked for the party. And you could be hired to be one of the guys that slice up bread for the breakfast. That could literally be your job.
Jeez.
And if you didn't want to work with that, then you needed to go to a party commissar and ask nicely with your hat in your hand, and like, can I do something else? And he would be like, no, why would you want to do that? So, and that's the system that we're going into. And
yeah.
What separates from what was then to what is now is, like, when you look at Soviet Union, what made it possible. We have had a communist dictatorship before in history. Now I don't remember a specific German town that tried it out in the Middle Ages, but it's the technology. The reason why it was just one town in medieval Germany is because you only had a horse and a cart. You can't centralize goods like you can if you have a train system. And what was happening during the late 1800s, yeah, we developed a good train infrastructure. And with the new technology, new great minds come alive and like, yeah, we can use this infrastructure to centralize all goods, and then we can distribute it to whoever needs them. So people don't have those who have too much doesn't need, can share it with those who doesn't have that much. So they put themselves on those places, and it's all made possible due to technology. So it's,
yeah,
technology advancement is very, very scary in that sense, because it can be used against the humankind. And now it's not just the train infrastructure that makes communism possible. We have the digital infrastructure. And it's not just a digital infrastructure. Our entire monetary system will be soon digitalized, which makes the previous communist era of Soviet Union to will look like a kindergarten compared to what is possible to make alive with the technological advancement that we have today.
Absolutely. Central bank digital currencies that can basically be a programmable currency, they call it. You can just approve or disallow certain purchases, and they can track and trace everything. It's absolutely crazy. Jonas, a couple of things here before we end the first segment, and we're going to continue in part two here at redeyesmembers.com. When Migration Becomes Conflict, mention the book, and this is actually the last time you were on the show, we were talking about this, but this is the English version is out now. So tell us about the book.
It's when you talk about migration and the problems that arise from it, we have an information overload from perspective that regards criminality, regards financial argument, and I find those perspectives to be superficial. So I dig a little bit deeper into what is it that makes migration problematic on a more fundamental level. And I think anyone that takes interest in this subject will have some food for thoughts with this one.
Very good. When migration becomes conflict, you know, very good topic. Again, check out the last interview with Jonas, and then if you want to find out more, pick up a copy of the book. It's available on freespeechlibrary.com. So check that out. And then, of course, we have Palestra Media as well. This is the main website, palestramedia.com. And from there, Jonas, people can watch the latest documentary. There's links to your, whether they want to watch it on YouTube, Palestra Media, you can find them right there. Or Odyssey, I think. Are we on BitChute as well? Do you have a BitChute channel?
No, we are on Odyssey, YouTube, and for our Swedish viewers, we are also on SwebTV's platform, SwebTube.
Nice. That's right. They set up their own. That's good. That's good to find out. You're also on Telegram, of course. Make sure you follow them over there. It is absolutely not, unfortunately, a solid option when it comes to censorship, as we've seen recently with a lot of the Russian channels. RT Sputnik is gone. Before that, there was a number of other places. But they're slightly better, right? Slightly better. Yeah. Gab is actually pretty good. They seem to be a solid, like, free speech, actually, kind of platform, right? But yeah, so the latest documentary here, The Power Brokers You Never Elected, it's available, the English version literally came out about 2 weeks ago. Check it out. And then, well, actually, both of them came out at about the same time, right, actually?
Yeah, when working on this documentary, it was almost like doing three movies in one, because we had the premiere on the Swedish book and media fair. And I got
the one in Gothenburg, or which one was it?
No, it's the alternative Swedish book and media.
Oh, okay, got you. Cool.
I was like, did they let you in? Anti-establishment.
Did they let you in there?
Yeah. So I needed to do a 25 minutes version just for that premiere, and then I did the Swedish version and the English version, and worked. With them parallel within the end. The most we do on Palestra Media is in Swedish, but we also have a complete English channel, which we posted this English version of the documentary, and we will do, whenever we do something in English, we will post it on that. And that's the YouTube channel of Boer Project.
Yes, exactly. You've done that. That's available there too. The Boer Project. That's good. You did one on the genderless society, which of course ties into all of this as well. It's just right there. Post-human world. That's where things are going. All right. Very good. So that's some of the sources you can check out and find more from Jonas Nilsson, Palestra Media. Check out the latest documentary. Pick up a copy of his book. Stay with us, Jonas. We'll be right back in part two. All right, boys and girls, so we'll continue with Jonas Nilsson from Palestra Media in the second part. Head on over to redicemembers.com. Sign up right there. Get access to the second hour and other exclusive material. Weekend Warrior, we have exclusive videos for you guys there as well. We've bombarded quite a bit extra here recently in the member section as well. So head on over there. We cannot do this without your support. Red Ice is possible because of our members. So thank you for your support. And by the way, we do have a Subscribestar as well. Subscribestar.com/redice. That's a good way of supporting us, but of course you can also sign up for a membership over there. So if you do it over there using your debit or credit card, just send us a DM, a direct message on Subscribestar. Tell us what username you have on redicemembers.com, what your account is there, and we'll activate your account right away. You can also send us an email, redice@protonmail.com, and let us know the same. We have a number of other ways that you can sign up, of course, the Cash App, we have crypto. We have e-check option if you're in the U.S. You can also sign up using Entropy Stream. Join us in the second hour. Much more coming up. Don't miss this exciting continuation with Jonas Nilsson. Very good discussion regarding where things is going, the bigger picture, the transhumanist agenda, but also the shortage issue, the supply chain issue, the food shortage issue as well. Very important stuff. But we're also going to talk a bit about how we can become resilient against those drastic changes that might be coming down the pipe. So join us at redicemembers.com. See you over there.